Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Meghna Chakrabarty. States are reopening, and that means so are the places where we work. Offices, gyms, restaurants, movie theaters, and more. As the weather heats up, employers are rolling out return-to-work plans. How does that make you feel? There is a sense out there that after 15 months of working through a pandemic, going back to normal just won't cut it, because lots of people are feeling the heat of burnout. And consider this. According to the Pew Research Center, 66% of the unemployed seriously considered switching professions. Meanwhile, nearly 2 million women who left the labor force last year have yet to return to work. So, is it time to rethink our relationship with work? Let's hear briefly from Jane Grant, a physical therapist in Louisville, Kentucky. Even before the pandemic, Jane struggled with her managers at a large healthcare provider.
In January 2020, when I was cited for rolling my eyes during a meeting, and they used that to kind of like at my annual performance review to essentially not give me a raise. And but then tell me that I was the highest performing therapist that they had and all these different things.
Grant says that as a Black woman, she didn't feel valued or respected. Then the pandemic hit.
I was like, okay, well, I'm going to stick it out. Like, I'm going to try and stick it out. I'm not a quitter. I can do it. I can face this challenge.
Grant says her and her other colleagues scrambled to work hard to treat their patients during the early days of the pandemic. But she says the feedback from her bosses and the low pay were out of step with her performance.
As I continue to work with this company, I just continue to experience a lot of, you know, just anxiety, issues with like depression, weight gain, struggling with things. I went to a functional medicine practitioner. My doctor was like, you're just stressed. It's your job. Like, you're just stressed out. It's okay.
Grant was burnt out. 3 months into the pandemic, she quit.
And to be treated like that by my company was like, oh no. And it's in the middle of a pandemic? Absolutely not. This is crazy. There's enough going on already. Like, why are we doing this? So I just made a choice. Like, I cannot give my time to people that, you know, are trying to not see my value.
Grant moved into her parents' house and focused on her small business, selling medicinal herbs and wellness services. Taking on the financial risk was scary, but she says it was worth it.
If anything that COVID, you know, showed us and taught us was that, you know, life is short and it's unpredictable. So why not live it thriving? Why not live it in joy? Why not live it and be present in it? It's like, oh, well, if you're not doing something, then you're not being productive. You're not being productive is the word. You're not being productive. You're not, you know, you're not working. And being okay and saying rest is okay. Rest is okay.
That was Jane Grant, founder of Blooming Herbalist Apothecary in Louisville, Kentucky. This hour on Point, we're reimagining our relationship with work. After more than a year of unprecedented stress and change, can we put life instead of work, back at the center of our lives? And can workplaces, our employers, meet that challenge? Let's go now to Anne Helen Peterson and Charlie Warzel. They're journalists who've been investigating burnout and the workplace for their forthcoming book, Out of Office, The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. They join us now from Missoula, Montana. Charlie, Anne, welcome to On Point. I've been looking forward to talking to you about this.
Thanks for having me. Thank you so much.
So, Anne, I'll start with you. What happened to work when the pandemic hit? How did that contribute to burnout?
Well, I think there's two different ways that work changed when the pandemic hit. So there were people who still had to go into work. And that was just, you know, a fear that I think if you weren't going into work every day, it's hard to understand or to describe that accumulating anxiety that you were exposing yourself and then also, you know, the people that you lived with, many of whom were vulnerable in other ways to exposure to this disease every day. And even if you could get through and rationalize like, okay, I have to do this today. And then you wake up again and you're like, okay, I got to do it again tomorrow. And you could do it on a day-to-day basis. Still, like the stress and the anxiety of that building up over months and months, and also oftentimes dealing with people in the public who, for various reasons, you know, might not be on their best behavior. Like that is just a huge amount of exhaustion that accumulates. And then the second type of work, this sort of work that pivoted to being done from home, or for people like ourselves who are journalists who were doing the work from home before, I think a lot of us double down on just working more, right? Like trying to distinguish yourself, because especially in the beginning, there were these fears that who knew what was going to happen with the economy. Mm-hmm. So better make yourself, you know, a really good worker. But then also a lot of people were trying to deal with caretaking responsibilities and their kids running around at home and trying to figure out like Zoom school, all these different things all at once. And so whether you were rolling over and starting your work at 7 a.m. as soon as you woke up and then working until 7 p.m. or trying to just find these snatches of time that you could work, a whole year of doing that is going to take a toll.
Right, right. And it has for millions of people. We put out a call yesterday. We asked for listeners to tell us their experience with burnout. And On Point listener Rachel left us this message. She's from Somerville, Massachusetts, and she talked a little bit about her experience with work over the past year.
I'm calling about burnout, and I feel really burnt out by my job, which is weird because I don't feel like I'm doing it very well or doing anything at all. But I can't tell if I don't like working remotely, if I don't like working at all, or if I don't like my job specifically. And it's really taxing, and I sleep all day instead of doing work.
All right. That was Rachel from Somerville. Charlie, you know, we've sort of based this hour on the idea that burnout is a thing out there. What do we know about it? I mean, in terms of numbers, what do we base that on?
Oh, well, I mean, numbers are somewhat difficult to come by when you're talking about something like burnout. So I mean, a lot of it is anecdotal, but there are plenty of surveys out there that are showing that workers are less engaged in work. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but this is a global phenomenon. I mean, there, you know, over time, especially in the last 5 years, you're watching a workforce that sort of feels like the listener right there, that, you know, they're starting to wonder, you know, whether or not they even like to work in general. And I think that I think that comes from, you know, not feeling a lot of satisfaction towards your job, not feeling like you have, you know, a sense of that your bosses have a sense of trust in you, that they're you know, willing to give you the free and creative rein to do your job in you know, in interesting and expansive ways. And so the result of that is a disengagement from one's job. And I think the pandemic has put such a stress on that, because if you feel that way, if you already are feeling a little bit disengaged, or, you know, not rewarded creatively, or just that your general labor and presence isn't rewarded with anything other than, you know, your salary, then I think that, you know, the pandemic has given people even more removed from that. You know, there are people who, for all the wonderful benefits of working from home, there are people who just don't work very well from home. People who, you know, aren't as good as managing their time. And so I think, you know, what we're seeing with burnout is the fact that all these problems existed well before the pandemic, and the pandemic has just really highlighted and exacerbated a lot of them and brought them up to the surface. It's just very clear if you are in a job where you don't feel respected or challenged or compensated fairly. You know, the pandemic has made that just crystal clear to a lot of people, and I think they might have been sort of suppressing that or you know, hiding it from themselves before, but it's you can't hide from it now.
Yeah, and I was really struck when we heard from Jane Grant from Louisville. I mean, she talked about why she quit her job and sort of took a chance on redefining essentially her profession. And her final statement there was like, if the pandemic has taught us anything, it's taught us that life is fragile, it's fleeting, things can change in a hurry. So if you have a dream, live it now. I mean, Anne, is that sort of part of what you think people are feeling out there?
Oh, I think people are just like, I'm so exhausted. I can't keep doing the thing that I'm doing.
Yeah.
Something's got to change, right? Something's got to give. And if something's got to give, I have this unique opportunity to kind of remake my life in a way that I want it to be, right? To match the rhythms that I like to work, or to follow pursuits that I wasn't able to follow because of the way that work was structured before. And I think some people, this is not true for everyone by any means, but whether you were collecting unemployment checks or stimulus payments, or if you were still working throughout the pandemic, just not spending a lot of money, there are a lot of people out there who have some financial cushion that is making these sorts of transitional moves possible.
That's super interesting. Yeah, because it really did sort of slow down the kind of conventional spending pattern. So I'm not surprised to hear that. Charlie, we're going to talk a lot throughout this hour about what needs to happen and how we should restructure work. Among your ideas is you've proposed a summer slowdown. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that and why it's necessary?
Yeah, absolutely. In some of the reporting that we've done for this book, and just in some of the, you know, the anecdotal conversations I've had with people across different industries and you know, the reporting that we're continuing to do on this, I think one thing that we're seeing is a real resentment that is building up. There's this notion that a lot of employers, a lot of bosses are starting at this moment where, you know, we're starting to have more people vaccinated. There's this, you know, cautious re-entry into the world.
Charlie, I'm going to jump in because we're coming up against a time break here. Sorry to jump in on you. We're going to take a short break, come back. You're going to finish that thought. Listeners, we're talking about worker burnout and the future of the workplace after the pandemic. Are you feeling burned out at work? We want to hear your stories, especially if you found solutions in your workplace. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Post your thoughts or your questions there. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and with summer on the way, we're talking about worker burnout and the opportunities that workplaces now have to meet the needs of employees. My guests are Anne Helen Peterson and Charlie Warzel. They're journalists who cover burnout and the workplace. Their forthcoming book is Out of Office, The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. And Charlie, before the break, you were just getting going on explaining why you're proposing a sort of summer slowdown and how that what that would look like.
Yeah, so what we're seeing in a lot of our reporting right now is it's both anecdotal and it's also just it's very apparent in sort of the broader trends that we're seeing, but there's a frustration right now. There's a real resentment with laborers towards a lot of employers, because what we're seeing is, as the world is sort of opening up, as more people are being vaccinated, there's a lot of executives and bosses acting as if, you know, the pandemic kind of didn't happen, right? Okay, mm-hmm. There, you know, even that phrase, and you mentioned this earlier in the show, of, okay, it's time to get back to work.
Right.
There is a huge amount of resentment from workers who have been working this entire time and being incredibly productive in these, you know, extraordinary circumstances, hiding from a deadly virus and getting the work done. And to hear that phrase, back to work,
Like, what have we been doing
really
for the last 15 months?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so this feeling, you know, and employers are forcing people to kind of come back right away. Frontline workers who are getting hazard pay, that's being rolled back in some places. Over the pandemic, executive compensation rose in proportion to wages again. And there's this immense amount of frustration on top of the actual burnout. And, you know, writing and thinking about this, I thought something does have to change. There has to be at least some small release valve. And we do need to sort of celebrate the great fortune we have of having these vaccines, of being able to sort of slowly, cautiously reintegrate ourselves into society. And so, I polled a ton of different people on Twitter to ask them about, you know, what would they like, their employers to do to sort of give them a little bit of a release and a little bit of support for this summer. And that's where the idea of the summer slowdown came from. And that's everything from summer Fridays to, a real institution of a 4-day work week to chunks of time that are off where a large part of the company is actually off, so that you don't go away and then have work piled up at your desk when you get home. But it's about sort of changing our expectations of, you know, what we can demand and expect from work, and trying to kind of decenter that from our lives a little bit.
Well, in terms of what companies can do, we heard from Martha Shaughnessy. She's the founder of The Key PR, a communications firm in San Francisco. And she left a message with us telling us how her company restructured their work schedule to allow employees more time to rest during the pandemic.
We instituted rotating Fridays, where the majority of the team takes Friday off and we leave a bare bones group to cover work and allow their teammates to rest. And the other thing we did was create a spring break schedule with forced 2 weeks off. It was the advice of a DEIB counselor that we brought in to help us further refine what we're doing as a team. And she said, above everything else, people seemed tired.
So people seem tired there. I'm struck, Anne, by the idea of a forced 2 weeks off. And this is a thing, because a lot of people have time to take off, but they can't really take it off, or they don't, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of companies are not built in a way. They do not have the redundancies, which, you know, we think of that as a word with a lot of negative connotations, but it's a word that means that someone can take time off, whether this is for, you know, paternity or maternity leave, or just actual time off, and the company won't collapse, the organization won't collapse, or there won't be a huge pile of work that is there waiting for them when they get back. And I think a lot of companies, especially newer companies, have tried to embrace this model of leanness that means that there is very little redundancy built into the org charts. And so someone looks at the prospect of taking 2 weeks off and says, not only would I have so much work that would be waiting for me when I got back, but also I'd be letting my team down in some capacity. And people have these really strong feelings of, you know, trying to be there for their team through the pandemic. However difficult it was working remotely, I do think that people feel connected and like they owe each other something. And so unless your company makes a really concerted effort to encourage it and also try to make it so that there won't be these piles of work when people get back. And one of the ways that you can do that is by taking an all company week off, as I know some companies, depending on the type of work that you do, are able to do that. But that's something, you know, you can stagger it a little bit. You could be like, we're going to take a lot of people are going to take this 1 week off in June and, you know, then people in July or August, but you have to be really mindful about it. And that's something that some companies are doing really well. And some companies are saying, oh, well, let's just spring back to work as normal.
Can you talk also about this idea? I think, and this is your language, this idea, the tyranny of feel free to take some time if you need it. In other words, the time is there to take. And of course, our employees need to take time off. And if you need it, take the time, take the time. But that isn't really the same thing as take the time off. You need it.
Totally. And I think, you know, anyone who's worked in America knows that phrase that like, oh, yeah, you know, I know that you're probably pretty tired coming back from all of this. Feel free to take some time if you need it, which I think is just a sorting mechanism, right? The phrase there, feel free to take some time if you need it, it is asking, it is trying to sort out the sort of person who needs time, right? Who needs recovery, who is not a worker, who is ready to just power through. And the sort of person who can be like, yeah, I guess I probably do need it, but I don't have to take it. I can continue to work. And so it really puts the impetus on the individual worker to try to decide, you know, am I going to try to distinguish myself as someone who doesn't need this PTO? Or am I going to be the person who says, yeah, actually, I need rest, which, you know, we can talk about this now and be like, oh, of course you should do that. You know, listen to yourself, take the time that you need. But a lot of times in work scenarios, there's a lot to be lost by signaling to your managers that you're the sort of person who needs recovery.
Charlie, I want to come to you and ask you about the potential, the bigger promise. This is sort of part of the title of your book, The Bigger Promise of Working from Home. And so this raises the question in my mind, what working during the pandemic taught us about what we could do better. I mean, and lots of us have been working mostly remotely, which in theory gives us more control over our schedules, less commuting, more time with our families, maybe time to exercise. So what worked over the past 15 months around working from home? And I also want to be really clear that lots of people didn't have this option, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But this idea of working from home, what's the potential there? And what did we learn that we can carry forward post-pandemic?
I think the biggest lesson that we learned and what sort of undergirds the entire book is that it's possible that, you know, so many people were told over and over again for decades that, well, you know, if it's a slippery slope, if you know, maybe you want to work a Friday every so often from home, and that may be okay, but if everyone starts doing that, you know, productivity is going to drop. We're not going to be able to get the job done. The work will suffer. The quality will suffer. You know, company culture will suffer. All these things, and what the pandemic really proved, you know, is this kind of control group experiment that showed, you know, productivity didn't suffer. The work didn't suffer necessarily. I mean, in some cases, obviously, you know, there are things that aren't ideal, but, you know, workers are very creative and very resilient, and especially in jobs that, you know, they have a lot of pride in, will get the job done. And so the book, the bigger promise in the book is this notion that ideas, especially as they pertain to work, that seemed once completely inflexible are actually pretty flexible, actually pretty malleable. This phrase that we've been using to describe it is borrowed from some other authors, but it's this idea of a plastic hour, right? Where everything is sort of, you know, malleable in terms of the future. And so with that notion that we actually can do this, that it's not going to just destroy our economy and our work lives, there's so much promise, there's so much potential to rethink first principles about the way that we work, about the way that work, you know, sits in our lives. Right now, for many people, it is, you know, it is where they spend the absolute, you know, majority of their time. And that's over family, that's over community, that's over volunteering, that's over doing things with friends and family. And so the notion here is that if you actually do have this ability to rethink the first principles, what is possible? What can we actually do? And I think, you know, the real premise of the book is that, you know, it just right now, it doesn't have to be this hard. It doesn't have to be this painful. There is a way to do these jobs differently. You know, we surveyed, you know, almost 1,000 different workers, and we didn't even ask this question, but at some point in the survey, people confess that they get most of their work done for the week in like a 4-hour burst of productivity. Right. And then the rest of the time they're just performatively working. And that's just, right, you know, indicative of a broken system. So, you know, we have this opportunity now to rethink everything. And I think generally this will be both good for employers and employees.
Right. So when we talk about sort of revisiting some of the principles that we sort of took for granted even before the pandemic, for instance, working 9 to 5, sitting in an office chair by 9 o'clock Monday and not leaving that office chair till 5 o'clock on Friday, working, I don't know, a 5-day week, Monday to Friday. All of those things are sort of up for grabs now, in your view, or should be at least reconsidered. Is that fair? And Anne, chime in if you want, but I'll ask that question to both of you.
Yeah, everything is up for grabs. I mean, at a past place where I worked, I was the remote employee, and I came in, and one Wednesday evening, everyone was just kind of sitting around their desks. It was 6 o'clock at night. The sun had gone down, and I was saying, well, what's everyone doing here? And they said, oh, well, we don't leave till, you know, the boss leaves. And I said, do you have any work to do? No. Well, why are you still here? And it's again, this performative, this performative thing. And so, you know, I think a lot of, especially bosses, are really worried about doing anything different than they did before, because what they did before feels safe. But
right, it's what they know. It's what they know. Yeah,
exactly. But I think now we can change that up, and we can structure our lives so that work is an important part of them, but not the only part of them.
Mm. I like the sound of that. Well, I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Felicia Davis is the CEO of the Chicago Women's Foundation. And Felicia, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start with you just talking about this issue that we know over the past year, more than 4.2 million women dropped out of the labor force. Nearly 2 million of them still haven't returned. There's a lot of ways to analyze that, but I want to ask, you know, what's the headline there? What does that tell you needs to happen in terms of reorganizing the way we make it possible or impossible for people to work?
Thank you. This is a really important question, and I'm glad that Charlie and Anne have been wrestling with it as well. You know, women's workforce participation is at the lowest level since 1988, which is really significant for us. This pandemic has demonstrated to our society here how pivotal and how really important it is to have women in the workplace, but also the structures that existed to make that possible. And that includes the childcare, access to childcare, and a lot of the other protective things, paid sick leave, and policies that allow flexibility and options for working people, or really working moms. You know, households led by women have been the most impacted by this, the pandemic and the economic downturn. So there's a lot of ways that we can support getting women back to work, which is really helpful for our entire economy and certainly helpful to the bottom lines of businesses.
You put childcare on the top of that list, and I want to talk to you a little bit about that. I was interviewing Senator Elizabeth Warren recently, and she said something sort of remarkable to me. She studied bankruptcy, and one of the things she said was the biggest predictor that someone will go bankrupt is being a single mother. And the reason for that, the top reason for that, is the lack of affordable childcare. And it's obviously something that she's been advocating for a very, very long time. But Felicia, I mean, it seems like we've been talking about the need for affordable childcare for a long, long time. It's still not there. But that is crucial, isn't it, in terms of figuring out ways to get some of those 2 million women back into the workforce?
Absolutely. It is. It is why the conversation has shifted, and our president has talked about it as essential infrastructure. And I know there were quarters of our society who pushed against that, but the reality is that structure, the infrastructure that allows for productivity in the United States and for children to be taken care of actually benefits us all. Billions of dollars are being lost from economic productivity out of our economy because so many women are sitting on the sidelines, and many of them not by choice. If they've had to make these hard choices of, I need to take care of my family, I need to manage remote learning for my children, I don't have access to childcare, and so it has crippled our economy. An economist, a U.S. economist, has said in other places they have real infrastructure and support, and in the United States we have women, and we've seen what's happened to our economy when the essentials, childcare, thinking of it as an essential need or requirement, has been dismantled and frayed.
Well, the kind of sort of revisiting some of the fundamentals that Anne and Charlie are talking about, is that going to help this? In other words, is allowing female workers, women, mothers in particular, more flexibility to work from home, for example, is that going to help them in a big way?
Well, I think in this period of time, what we've seen corporations, companies, organizations, everyone who could really be flexible,
yeah,
increasing opportunities. And I also want to clarify something, because most of the time this issue has been talked about as a woman's issue. It is a family issue.
It's a great point. Felicia, I'm going to jump in only because we're coming up against a break, but we're going to pick up that thought when we come back after the break. We're talking about a relationship to work after a year of working through the pandemic and how we can reimagine that relationship with work. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. This hour, we're talking about burnout and reassessing our relationship to work. My guests are journalists Charlie Warzel, Anne Helen Peterson, and CEO of the Chicago Women's Foundation, Felicia Davis. And Felicia Davis, before the break, you were talking about the need for childcare, for a flexible workplace, and making the point that this isn't just a woman's issue. And I thought that was a really important point to make before I cut you off there.
No, I think, thank you for that. The U.S. was really facing a childcare crisis before the pandemic began. And so as the pandemic went on, providers said that without additional funding, they would have to close permanently or temporary closures lasting months. And so the number of childcare slots or spaces has dramatically decreased. And so the context of this isn't just a women's issue. And I think for the first time during the pandemic, people, our legislators, the president of the United States, CEOs of companies and organizations started talking about it. And I just want to make that point. This is an issue for all working families, mm-hmm. for working parents. The caregiving responsibility typically falls to women in our society. And so then it's easy for us to kind of cast it as a woman's only issue.
Right. No, it's a really important point to make. I want to play a little bit of tape because one of the big questions about all this, about creating a more flexible work environment, is how will management support the effort to change the workplace? So here's Sandeep Mathrani, the CEO of WeWork, who faced some backlash for his comments about remote work. He spoke at the Wall Street Journal's Future of Everything Festival.
No one is saying they don't want to go to work. They're saying, I want to go to work 2 or 3 days a week. I want to work for my place, whatever my place is, my comfort zone, a day or two a week. And I like to work from home a day a week, right? And effectively, it's also pretty obvious those who are uberly engaged with the company want to go to the office 2/3 of the time at least. Those who are least engaged are very comfortable working from home.
So, Charlie, I want to come to you about that. I mean, this idea sort of implicit in that statement is that idea, if you want to work from home, if you want to sort of have a more flexible way of going about your work, you're probably not really a very committed employee, right? This is something that people have to sort of fight against.
I'm so glad that he came out and just sort of, you know, said it and did it, because it's such a helpful, it's such an instructive you know, case here about a kind of really insidious argument that a lot of employers have. You know, engagement doesn't necessarily equal productivity, and I think a lot of people, you know, conflate that. If engagement is your desired goal, there's actually really compelling data that will suggest that employees are more engaged when they're not burned out or exhausted. Microsoft Japan did a 4-day work week trial, and productivity actually grew by 40%, with 92% of employees saying they were happier. There's this idea that, you know, just grinding away means that you're a good employee, and that's not necessarily true. And the other thing, just to the past point about, you know, this not just being like a women in the workforce issue, you know, one thing that truly flexible work does is, and truly distributed work where, you know, no one's required to necessarily be in the office, it really levels the playing field, because you don't have to have, you know, the caregivers be the ones who are staying home with then the, you know, the either the men or the younger employees who are in the office getting FaceTime with the boss and, you know, sort of being right there. If you do have this distributed workforce, then there's no stigma with working from home. There's no, you know, oh, well, this person, you know, is probably checked out a little bit because they're spending time, you know, helping their kids, et cetera, and giving, you know, care to their family. I think the leveling that playing field is why this definitely isn't just a gender issue. This is something, you know, a rising tide that lifts all boats.
And Felicia Davis, I'd love you to chime in on this question that was raised there. I mean, does flexible work equate to low performance? My guess is you would say it does not.
Absolutely not. There was a study recently by the Society of Human Resource Managers. They put out a lot of research, and it shows that performance did not diminish by the implementation of remote work. So that's a false trope, and I am happy to push against it. And I am happy also that Charlie is pushing against it as well.
Mm. So what are you doing as CEO of the Chicago Women's Foundation in terms of creating more flexibility going forward?
Yeah, so we, as a women's foundation, we center equitable policies and everything that we do, and we advocate for that everywhere we go. And so prior to the pandemic, we had remote work options. We have flexibility built in. And I heard this conversation earlier, there was a point during the pandemic where I closed the office for what I called collective rest so that we could all take a break. Simultaneously, because the thing that happens if I just take a vacation, the emails don't stop, or another member takes a vacation, the work continues, and then you actually feel much more stress coming back, which is why, you know, over half of Americans don't take vacation time or work while they're on vacation. So we have flexibility built in. We have summer hours typically in the summer, which means we have half days, between Memorial Day and Labor Day. And we have other, you know, I encourage and do it by example. I heard the conversation about, oh, take the time if you need it. It's something we talk about on a weekly basis. I model it myself, and we have our leaders model it so that everyone understands that it is more than okay. Like, it's required of us to have rest. You can't get from an empty well.
Right. Right. So, Anne, I'd love to ask you this question. And you know, what would you imagine if you could sort of dream it up? What would the workplace look like a year from now? I mean, if some of what you and Charlie are talking about and advocating for, what would it look like?
Wow. Well, I think that every company has to figure out the best scenario for them in terms of when do we actually need people in the office, in contact with one another, face to face. Because there is an argument in every single vocation that there are some things that are better done with that sort of, you know, face to face interaction. It is almost always less than people think it is. Right?
Yeah.
Like, you do not need to, you know, there are days where you probably spend most of your day responding to email. There is no reason why that has to be done in the office in the presence of others. And so I think once a company figures out how much presence time that they need, then giving employees the ability to work with managers to try to figure out, okay, what do we want our schedule to look like? I have a friend who works in a nonprofit. They just got their back to the office email, and they're doing, everyone needs to be in the office Tuesday through Thursday from 9 a.m. to, I think, 2 p.m. It's really not a ton of hours, and it gives a lot of room in the other spaces for people to figure out what works best for them. And also, you know, that 9 to 2 is really significant because it allows caregivers of children some leeway with school drop-offs and pickups and that sort of thing. And so I think as we move forward, first of all, I think having conversations with your actual employees about the schedules and that will work best for them and also their desires, and being open to changing over time too. You might in the beginning schedule too much time in the office, or you might not schedule enough, but understanding that this is something that's going to continue to change in the weeks and months and years to come is really important.
So I so want to believe in what you're pushing for and what you're advocating for, but I'm skeptical, and I want to just sort of express my skepticism to you and so that you can make me feel better.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to believe that it is possible that American workers can sort of restore a balance to their lives, put their lives kind of back at the center of their existence and not work so damn much, frankly. But I'm skeptical. And one of the reasons is that we're working so hard is because of structural issues in our economy that make it necessary. I mean, our health insurance is tethered to work in many cases. Defined retirement pensions are a thing of the past. If you work at the low end of the wage scale, you can risk working full time and still live in poverty. So until these big structural things are kind of dealt with, I'm just worried that it's not going to be enough to have a conversation with, you know, some corporations and say, hey, you got to encourage your employees to take more time off, maybe work from home a little bit. You know what I mean? And I'd like one of you or all of you to sort of respond to that concern of mine. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Felicia.
We need both and. So we do need to make major shifts in the structural nature of the way that we imagine work. The way that we work today is a product of a bygone era, and we just continue to hammer it out that way. It's a knee-jerk reaction to think that let's get everybody back to work and everything will be, you know, back to normal. But normal, this is the deepest thing that I want everyone to understand. It was not working before. People were exhausted before, especially women. Women were exhausted with all of the responsibilities, but they just kept going. It's like being on the hamster wheel. You just have to keep going. So we need both and. And I also want to bring in hourly workers into the conversation, because for the most part, the remote work that we've talked about in the context, it's really, white collar jobs that have the opportunity. But when we look at our economy, healthcare, hospitality, those industries have been really hit hard, and that many of those frontline and essential workers are hourly workers. So things that we could do structurally to change that. As you know, Chicago recently had legislation around predictive scheduling so that people, our workers, can plan, you know, time off, can plan and arrange for childcare, can have some time to kind of institute those things that the structure of, you know, a 9-to-5 or a remote work allocation allows those workers to do. So we need both and.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And you were about to chime in, I think, before Felicia started talking.
Oh, yeah. I am so in agreement with Felicia here. And her answers throughout this have, like, just a model of the sort of leadership that we need to have moving forward. I think that it's important for us to really recognize those structural needs, but also to be thinking about how we can try to change as well, right? I think this is something that sometimes we get caught up in, is like, oh, everything is broken. Like the capitalist system is making everything horrible. And it does, right? Like capitalism makes a lot of life miserable. But how can we continue to amend and regulate and shift capitalism in a way that makes life more livable and makes this balance between life and work more livable? And you can't depend on the private sector to fix this by any means. And so I think, to echo Felicia here, it has to be a both and. Yes, you can work to fix some of these things within your own company, make things better for you personally and for others at your company, but it's not going to actually change the way that we engage in the world, the way that community functions, any of this, if we don't make the structural changes that means that we can extend these shifts to everyone. And I'm not talking about, you know, flexible work. I'm talking about having our lives less tethered, less bound to the wheel of work.
Well, in terms of sort of coming back to this idea of the hybrid workplace, flexible workplace, taking some of what we've learned during the pandemic and extending it out into the future with remote learning, I'm sure you, Anne and Charlie and Felicia, I'm sure you saw this as well. The Boston Globe ran a piece recently by John Levy. It got a lot of traction. And he wrote that the hybrid workplace probably won't last. Among other things, he argues that remote work will hurt trust, cause employees to go unseen, make them feel isolated. He even talks about the benefits of commuting because it gives us time, supposedly, to process our days and let our minds wander. Charlie, what do you make of that argument?
I think it's a good example of a lot of the sort of, you know, the straw man arguments around why the office is so important. It's very much the, you know, well, this is the way that we did things before, so things are gonna snap back. You know, when we're talking about why workers, you know, might be bad at putting boundaries on their time, you know, what's left out of that conversation is you know, what workplaces demand of you. And you know, I think that there's this idea with remote or hybrid work that it's going to be, that it could be this easy thing, right? And that you can just tell your employees, hey, you know, you're working from home now, congratulations, bye. You know, what we argue for in the book and what we've seen is that, like, this is going to take a lot of work. This is rethinking. You know, this is not just, you can't just, you know, take your HR representative and slap on a head of remote work title and, you know, tell them to do this, you know, 25% of the time and expect good results. This is rethinking everything. You know, Annie wrote this line for our book, but it's remote work is not about the where, it's about the how. It's about how we do these things. And I think that is what's really crucial. And yes, people, you know, will struggle with FaceTime with bosses, or, you know, they will, you know, have bad time management if employers don't actually set up systems and supports for employees to succeed at this. This is talking about, you know, again, rethinking those first principles of how we do work. And it's going to take bosses to model vulnerability, you know, to do what Felicia is doing and actually model the behavior that they want by taking the time off, by listening to employees and actually, you know, taking the feedback and crafting work policies that fit their needs instead of just sort of prescribing. So this is actually going to be really difficult work. But what I think is really important, and it sort of speaks to the last question you asked about, like, you know, whether this can actually happen or whether it's a, you know, pie in the sky ideal, is that this is a long-term benefit for executives, for businesses. You want to align your company's goals with your employees' goals. That is actually what gets productivity. That's what keeps turnover from happening, keeps you from the rehiring costs. It's good for everyone.
Well, Charlie Warzel and Anne Helen Peterson, they're journalists and they're authors of the forthcoming book, Out of Office, The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. Anne, Charlie, thank you so much for putting these important ideas, these hopeful ideas on the table. I'm rooting for them. So I thank you for the book.
Yes.
And
thank you so much.
Yeah. And Felicia Davis, CEO of the Chicago Women's Foundation, thank you so much for joining us today. It was great having you in the conversation.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.